Hey, welcome back to the Personality Hacker Podcast. My name is Joel Mark Witt.
And I'm Antonia Dodge.
And we have a very special guest today with us. We've invited Beatrice Chestnut. She's a psychotherapist, a business coach, and consultant. And she's the author of two books on the Enneagram. The one that's most recently been released is called The 9 Types of Leadership. And then she had a book before that called The Complete Enneagram. And she's been studying the Enneagram for over 27 years. Antonia and I both picked up a copy of her book in the last few months and we're like, wow, this is amazing stuff. We have to have her on the show. So Beatrice, welcome to Personality Hacker.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So one of the things that stands out about how you teach the Enneagram, at least for me as a, I'm primarily a Myers-Briggs enthusiast, but I love the Enneagram. So I've done a lot of deep dive study into it. And I noticed right away that your approach to the Enneagram is different than some of the other books that I've read. And one thing I noticed right away is how accessible your material is. You break it down, you make it very simple to understand. And I'm curious to know what your story is around, like, what made you fall in love with the Enneagram and decide to, you know, repurpose, repackage it in a way that is very easy for other people to access the material?
Oh, well, I'm really glad to hear you find it accessible because that's exactly what I wanted to do. I first learned the Enneagram in 1990, and I wasn't in the field of psychology. I wasn't planning to study the Enneagram, but I learned it through a friend's father. He told me one night at dinner that I was probably a type two. And so I went and read Helen Palmer's first book about what it said about two, and it just absolutely... It sort of rocked my world. It was so fascinating to me that I just never dreamed that there could be something that could describe me to myself in such clear, accurate terms, both in terms of kind of what I knew to be true about myself on more on the surface, but also things that I barely was aware of and certainly didn't really want to admit that it was kind of helping me face. And so I got interested in it. I was about to go to graduate school in a different field, so I did that. But when I was done with that degree, I moved back to California and got into my own therapy for the first time. I got a women's group. I kind of started doing some personal development work. That was a lot motivated by the Enneagram and how interested I was in it and how much it really helped me. So that was sort of the early story. And then, as I was around in the Enneagram world for a while, I got certified as a teacher. And based on how much I liked the Enneagram, I actually decided to go back to school and become a therapist. And so I studied psychology having known the Enneagram first. And so I really was sort of thinking in Enneagram terms all the time as I studied psychology and then became a therapist. And, having clients and seeing using the Enneagram in my mind to kind of understand them and find out the best ways to help them it just became part of the way I thought and such a deep aspect of the work I was doing in the world. And there were a couple motivations in terms of writing my first book, The Complete Enneagram. One of them was I thought I had some things to say about the types that could make them more simple and accessible from the point of view of someone who was a working psychotherapist. So that was one thing. I felt like, some of the books hadn't been written by psychotherapists. Certainly Jerry Wagner's book is an exception, but I think came out a few years before mine. And so that was one thing. And then the other thing was I learned a different version of the subtype personalities, which we can talk about what that means in a minute, in 2004. And that learning the subtypes was such a powerful experience for me on the level of learning my type in 1990. It really opened up a whole new level of my own personal work. And so I was also really motivated to bring those to a wider audience than I thought was really knew about them. And so it was sort of that twofold wanting to bring more people into the Enneagram and from the point of view of understanding the psychology of the types and how to work with that for self-improvement, and also wanting to bring the subtype information out to people who already knew the Enneagram but wanted sort of this added dimension or might be interested in it.
Yeah. Now, what I'm hearing you say basically is, and I don't know the world to much degree, but being a psychotherapist and coming to it from that framework, I'm guessing a lot of psychotherapists or a lot of people in that world, do they use tools like the Enneagram in their practice? Or is that very unique to you coming from that framework?
You know, I was really surprised. I continue to be really surprised at that. There are a lot of therapists who don't use the Enneagram. And I think it's partly a function of how we get trained, usually in certain methodologies or in certain theories. You know, you become either sort of a somatic practitioner or you adhere to psychoanalysis or certain psychodynamic theories. And so I think people get kind of rooted in what they've learned. And so, you know, when I was an intern, you know, and it's hard being a therapy intern because you're, you know, put in the position where people are coming to you for help and you're just learning how to help them. You don't really know yet. And I found it an incredible tool. I used to think of it as my secret weapon. And I used to say to my intern colleagues, you know, you guys have to use this tool because it makes the whole process more comprehensible, and it helps you get to the heart of the matter with people very quickly and find out what's going to help them the fastest.
Why? Why does it help so much? What have you found the usefulness from it?
Well, I think it stems from the fact that the Enneagram personality types are such accurate descriptors of not only patterns of thinking, feeling, and behaving, but also how they all work together to provide kind of a defense in early life, a defensive system for dealing with the world that helps you survive in early life, but then becomes a kind of invisible, overly rigid way of being by the time you reach adulthood that is completely, you know, unseen often. You know, we don't know what our blind spots are. We don't know what we don't know. We think that our way of operating in the world is the way everyone operates, and we don't question it because it's so familiar to us and it's been around so long. And often it's what our strengths are based in, you know? And so, I found that it was, you could, just gain so much from understanding yourself through the Enneagram lens because it was such an accurate way of and such a clear way of understanding why I do what I do.
Yeah.
What I like about you taking the approach coming from a psychotherapist, meaning that you've actually had to, I mean, you've used this when working with clients, and I'm assuming you've given, you know, strategies and, you know, recommendations for behavior based on this knowledge. And then you've had to get feedback then with your clients to determine whether or not it panned out for them. So what I like is that it's not left in the world of theory for you.
Academia.
Right. Like when you've been using it actively and then getting real world feedback on whether or not the things that, you know, the advice you've been giving based on the system is actually working.
Right. Exactly. And it's interesting because you see people come into your office and you see the patterns in the people. So it's like people start to tell you their story and you start to see their type and you start to be able to, you kind of know what's coming. Now, of course, you have to always hold that very lightly because you don't want your beliefs about personality to cloud how you're seeing someone in all their authenticity. But you start seeing the same patterns over and over again. And so it really, it gives you an even clearer sense of how these, here's a totally new person who's a completely unique individual, but they're also a six and their patterns are showing up in the same way that I've seen other sixes show up. But in the same way, at the same time, they're completely their own individual.
Yeah. So I just want to take a moment here to talk to you, the audience member. If you don't know anything about the Enneagram, we have recorded podcasts in the past that are sort of primers that will give you a basis in the foundational or the fundamentals of the Enneagram. So my recommendation is to go back and check those out because I think we're going to go to a different space right now. We're going to talk a little bit about those instinctive variants and what you call the subtypes, Beatrice. And before we go deep into that, you mentioned that in 2004 you had an experience that, I mean, you had already felt the Enneagram was powerful, but then you had like another moment of a major aha. Can you describe that for us and talk about what was birthed from that aha for you?
Sure. So when I was studying the Enneagram in the 90s, from 1990 to 2004, the topic of subtypes would come up from time to time. And the subtypes are basically, they're three different versions or three different sort of sub personalities of each of the nine types. And every time the subject came up, I found it to be not very compelling. There wasn't as much information about what the subtypes were. I couldn't really find my subtype in it. I didn't really see how it was helpful. And so it almost irritated me a little bit when the subject would come up, because in my mind, it was just lacking the substance that the nine types had. So I would even at one point kind of leave the room when the subject came up, because it seemed like, felt like a little bit like an emperor has no clothes situation. Like, why are they talking about this if there's no there? But in 2004, everything changed, because the guy who I think of as really kind of the seminal author in the nine types and the Enneagram as most people use it today, Claudio Naranjo, he doesn't tend to teach in the U.S. very much, he came in 2004 to the International Enneagram Association Conference in Washington, D.C. The people who had organized the conference, I actually started on the board of directors of the conference that year, invited him to do three mornings at the conference on this topic of subtypes. And sort of to bring his study of it that he had not really spoken about in the U.S. for decades, probably since the early 70s, to the Enneagram community at this conference. So the first day he described all 27 subtypes, and this, again, that's the three versions of each of the nine types, three ways they can manifest based on which of three instincts is dominant in you. The three instincts being for self-preservation, for relating socially in groups, and for one-to-one bonding. It's sometimes called sexual. So he brought about 15 of his colleagues with him, and the first morning described all 27, and I heard a substance in his descriptions of these sub-personalities at a level of detail and nuance that I had never heard before. So it really got my attention, because I had been thinking, you know, I don't really get these subtypes things. But he described them in a way that was, I thought, was just amazing. So the next day, they put us all into groups. And that was the day where they came up to me and told me what subtype they thought I was. So I knew I was a two. I didn't really know which of the three I was, self-preservation, social, or one-to-one. I thought I might be a one-to-one, but I didn't really know. And they said, we think you're a self-preservation two. And I noticed my defenses going up, because the day before, I remembered pretty clearly when he was describing the three subtypes of type two, which is my type, that the self-preservation two was childlike. And I did not want to think of myself as childlike at all. It didn't sound like a complimentary thing or an attractive thing. So I had literally thought to myself, oh, that one's not me. That can't be me. So when they told me I was this childlike subtype, I really immediately sort of saw my wall go up, like, I don't want to hear that. But, you know, luckily I had been in therapy long enough that I could see my defenses go up and choose to lower them. So I asked the guy, I said, well, what do you mean by that? How do you know I'm a self-preservation too? And he did the most amazing thing. He stood next to me. It was almost an energetic comment. He stood next to me and he said, when I stand next to you like this, he was Italian. He said, I do not think you're going to protect me. I think I need to protect you. And it was so interesting. I felt just this recognition go through my whole body that I wanted to argue with him. I wanted to say, oh no, but I just knew he was right. I even though I didn't know what that meant yet, I just had a sense that he was pointing me in the direction of something that was really important for me to understand. So I went into my little group of self-preservation twos. There were only a few of us. And another one of Naranjo's colleagues came over and kind of helped our, we were supposed to talk about what we were like as self-pres twos. And of course we had no idea what that meant. So we didn't know how to do that. So, but another one of his colleagues came over and started asking us a few questions. Like, how fearful are you? And do you tend to trust people? And do you feel a kind of ambivalence about connection, even though you're a two? And most twos are very oriented toward wanting to connect with people. And it was just fascinating what came forward in my really asking myself, like, to be honest about the answers to these questions. And what I realized is that I was a lot more fearful than I thought I was, that I trusted almost no one, even though if you'd asked me a few years before that if I trusted people, I would have said yes, that I had a lot of ambivalence about connection, which I had kind of known before, but I had never really had a framework to understand it in, because that's not really one of the main characteristics of type two generally. So it opened up a whole new sort of world to me in terms of my own unconscious material that I hadn't really been aware of, you know. So I went back to my therapist and I said, hey, guess what? I realized I'm way more afraid than I thought I was. And he was like, finally, you're getting that. And he told me every time that he saw me and came to get me in the waiting room for our session, I would look terrified. And I hadn't really been fully conscious of what was going on for me. So it was like a, you know, 2.0. It was like a whole new world in terms of me learning about myself in you know, a lot of aspects that were really true, but that I hadn't really wanted to see or own. I mean, things that were kind of humiliating, actually, and that were sort of more part of my unconscious way of being in the world. And it was a huge opening in really understanding some of the things I needed to do to develop that I hadn't been seeing at all up until that point.
Yeah, it shone a light on a dark place, which I think is the power of typology systems when they're done well. Would you be willing to share some of the things that you did in order to, you know, like what were some of the things that became clear that you needed to do in order to develop as an Enneagram to self-preservation?
Sure. So, you know, the three different kinds of twos, you know, twos can, you know, one of the things about twos is we can be sort of charming or seductive, because twos don't want to ask for what they need. Sometimes it's hard to know what you need, but it's certainly hard to ask for what you need from people. And so we tend to try to get what we need from people indirectly by charming them into having positive, you know, rapport with us, into being in relationship in a positive way, in a friendly or more than friendly way. And what I learned is the self-preservation too, is charming in the same way that a child is charming in the presence of grown-ups. Kind of, it's like a cute two. It's someone who, and it was fascinating because, for instance, one of the things Naranjo said about self-preservation twos is that they tend to be the teacher's pet. And all my life, I had been the teacher's pet. And so it was so weird to kind of see that and remember that and go, what is going on there? And so what I realized is there's a kind of remaining young as a way of kind of unconsciously evoking care from other people. So twos are kind of known as big caretakers of other people. You know, what we're really good at is kind of sensing what other people need and providing that as a way of ingratiating ourselves in a way to create positive relationship. If I'm giving you things, if I'm supportive of you, if I'm friendly to you, you'll like me, is kind of the whole thing. So for me, I knew it was all about being likable, and I would feel a sense of well-being when people liked me. But I didn't see this aspect of kind of remaining young as a way of, as sort of this sort of the way of creating a character who people would like and want to take care of. So one of the things, for instance, I noticed about what was going on in my life at the time, and this is embarrassing to admit because I was, I think, around late 30s, early 40s, is that I was still being supported financially by my parents. Right. So again, I think I would have thought of myself at the time as very independent and not really paying much attention to the fact that I was, you know, getting some support from my parents. But I had to take a really hard look at that at the time. And so what I realized is, and this is one of the growth tasks of the self-preservation too, is a big part of what I needed to be focusing on was growing up. Right. So here I am kind of in late 30s, early 40s, and still being, in a way, kind of irresponsible Not when I was in my 20s, I would like not pay my bills. I wouldn't pay my parking tickets and my car would get towed, you know? And so, and unconsciously self-preservation twos don't want to take care of themselves because they want other people to do it. And again, it all roots back to sort of a childhood survival strategy, which is kind of like, well, often twos didn't get their emotional needs met as when they were young. And so it's kind of like taking an unconscious stance of, well, you didn't give me what I needed emotionally early on, so maybe it's kind of just and fair that you take care of me in other ways, financially in other ways, even in well into adulthood. So there was that unconscious dependency that I was maintaining, which wasn't good for me or anybody. So being able to realize, okay, I need to step into my power more. I need to be, you know, more of the authority in my own life and not outsource that to someone else as a way of kind of being stuck in this old way of being. I need to do things for myself more. I need to, you know, create real independence and not just sort of a fantasy of independence in my life. That makes sense.
Yeah, totally.
So thank you, by the way, Beatrice, for being so forthcoming and transparent with everything you just said. Because like you said, there's some personal growth stuff in there that you've obviously done a lot of work around to be able to share that with us publicly on the air. And I think this goes back to something that I think about the Enneagram. So, you know, we talk a lot about the Myers-Briggs system and other typology systems, as well as the Enneagram here. And what it is about the Enneagram that is coming up for me as you're talking is I'm going, oh, crap. I'm going to have to face my demons now. This isn't just about me identifying as like a Myers-Briggs type and how to grow. It feels like the Enneagram is going to dig up a bunch of the darkest parts of me or the places I'm going to have to like look in the mirror at myself and confront myself in a way that I might not be wanting or willing or ready to do like in the short term. That like I can see that being almost a place that pushes people away from doing this work if you really want to use it to the growth path that you want to use it to. I think that could be really frightening. And just hearing you say this all of a sudden made me go, well, maybe I don't want to go down the Enneagram road. Like I had that reaction as you're talking. I mean, I do,
right.
I do, but yeah. I'm like, I'm terrified to get to my, like, if we start talking, well, I think we're going to define some terms here and start talking about maybe even my Enneagram type and Antonia's as well. And now maybe I'm a little hesitant to that because it's like, oh crap. Like,
right. Right. Am I going to have to open a vein or what? Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So you listening, just hang with that because I think that might come up for you if you start to go down this road. If you get Beatrice's book and you start studying this and you start going down this road, it might require you to face some things that are some of the deepest parts of maybe when you grew up, some of the wounding you had, some of the challenges you had to overcome that this served you for, like Beatrice was talking about. But now it's become something that you are either dependent on or maybe it's overstayed its welcome, or maybe it's just not being used the way that it can be used the best. So
yeah.
If you're feeling any of those feelings, I'm feeling them too, I guess is all I'm saying.
Well, and I do want to say that if you use Myers-Briggs for personal development right, that will also happen. And at the same time, I think Enneagram is less forgiving. Like Myers-Briggs will let you avoid it forever if you want to. But I think the Enneagram doesn't let you off the hook as easy.
Like that is the work.
Yeah, that is the work. And so I think that's one of the reasons why Enneagram can be a little intimidating. So you were talking about defining terms, Joel, and Beatrice, we mentioned just a little bit in like a conversation we had before we started the podcast that one of the things that's a little complicated when you talk about things like subtypes and instinctive variants is that first you have to define even what you're talking about, like define the terms to begin with. So can you help us get a little clarity around what some of these terms mean as they relate to the 9 different types?
Because there's some reconciliation with the current, like the Enneagram community has some different ways of talking about this, right?
Yeah.
Right, right, right. Yeah, that's one of the tricky things about this subtype level of the Enneagram is that it's been a little confusing for a lot of Enneagram students because different teachers talk about it in different ways and use different terms and different names and different language. And so one of the reasons I wrote the book was to sort of try to make the complex subject of the Enneagram generally and also the subtypes more comprehensible for people and to bring some clarity to what's been kind of a confusing topic.
So what are some of the, so just kind of giving people an overview, you've got the 9 types, like right. and they get put into three different triads, and we've talked about this in previous podcasts, but within right. that, what is the difference between subtypes and variants? And
what do you even mean by subtypes? I think for somebody brand new listening, they might know what anagram is, but what is a subtype? It's almost like in Myers-Briggs, we talk about cognitive functions. It's like the new thing for a lot of people. They're like, what is that?
Yeah.
Right. So like you said, the Enneagram system starts with the idea that that humans are three-brained beings, and the number three has a lot to do with how the Enneagram is structured. And so we have three centers of intelligence: head, heart, and body. And then there are these nine types. Three types are kind of centered more in the head, three are centered more in the heart, and three are centered more in the body. Well, the body center has a lot going on in it. On one level, it's the center of sort of movement in the world, sort of taking action versus not taking action. But it's also sort of where the instincts are sort of live, or where they're housed, or where they come from. It's the reptilian brain. And we all, you know, humans are animals, and we share the instinctual level with animals, in that we all have certain basic instincts that are wired in biological drives that help us survive. And in the Enneagram system, the way there are three sort of groupings, or three main instincts that we talk about that have helped us survive. And that is, one is first just self-preservation. There's an instinct to survive, to stay alive, to get the food and water that you need to be safe. Then there's also an instinct for social relating, for getting along with the group. I like to say it in terms of getting along with the herd, right? All animals, you know, part of the way they survive is relating to the whole herd, the family group. And so that's the second one. And then the third one is for one-to-one bonding. And that's sometimes called sexual. I call it sexual in my first book. I call it one-to-one in my second book, largely because in business settings, often it's better to use one-to-one, because the sexual term can turn people off or get confused. So we have these three basic instincts. So that the word instinct refers to these basic wired in animal drives that are automatic, that are not subject to thinking at all. They just happen. You know, you don't have to think to drink when you're thirsty. You don't have to do things when you're a child to create safety or bonding with others. So then what the subtypes are, the subtypes refer to the idea that there's another breakdown into three. So we have these nine types, and each of the nine types comes in three different versions, depending on which of these three instincts has a sort of dominant presence in your life. So just like we tend to, all of us have one center that we're going from, and then I'm a heart type, right? So I'm a two. Two is housed in the heart. And then within that heart center, I sort of favor two as opposed to two, three, and four, the other two heart types. And then in the two type, I have a subtype that is more prominent in my experience, rather an instinct that's more prominent in my experience, and that is for self-preservation. That drives my behavior more than the other two instincts. And so sometimes people in the Enneagram community refer to the subtypes by the shorthand of instincts or instinctual variants, but I think that confuses matters, because really what we're referring to when we're talking about instincts are these biological drives, and in the Enneagram system, they refer to these three specific categories of instinctual drives: self-preservation, social, and one-to-one.
Okay, so just to make sure that I've got it. Basically, this is zooming in further and further. So if you zoom right. all the way out, you've got a set of three, which is heart, mind, and body.
Heart, two, three, four.
Yeah, right. And right. So if you zoom in, right, you've got three right. different numbers within each of those three right triads. So like right. you just said, Joel.
Sorry, I hijacked your, no, it's your okay. logic. I'm just excited and jumping. Go ahead.
Yeah. So yeah, all the way zoomed out, you've got three centers. You zoom in one level, and then you've got three within the three centers, which means nine. And then you zoom in right. one layer closer, and then each of those threes have three types or subtypes within them. And so you end up with 27 in total. And one of the things, the terminology that you're trying to avoid is calling self-preservation, social, and one-to-one as subtypes. Those are not subtypes. Those are variants. But when you marry...
Those are instincts.
Instincts.
They're instincts, right?
Excuse me. So when you have those three instincts and then you do the math, you overlay them onto the nine and end up with 27, now you have subtypes. It's the 27 that are subtypes. And then on the side is the model of the three instincts.
So the ingredients then for myself, if I'm an Enneagram 6, that's how I identify. And let's say the other ingredient is sexual or one-to-one. I mix 6 and one-to-one sexual together, and that it, the outcome of that, the equation of that, equals my subtype.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. And so that makes you a specific kind of 6 that looks different than the other two sixes, one that maybe has a more prominent social instinct or a more prominent self-preservation instinct.
So just to get an idea of how different these subtypes can look, would you be willing to do a little bit of a deep dive into Joel's type and my type to talk about how sixes can show up in three different subtypes and threes can, which is my type, threes can show up in three different subtypes?
Right. And before that, I want to say one more thing about this. So I think one of the reasons that there are different versions of the subtypes out there is because before we had the version, the approach to the subtypes that I write about and talk about, I think people did more of a kind of an addition, like, well, I'm a 6 and I tend to be very bonded with my partner, or I'm very keyed in these to one-to-one relationships. So I must be a 1-to-1 6. But the approach I'm using here is less about addition and more about alchemy. It's more like almost an interesting mix or multiplication of what do you get when you have 6 and the 1-to-1 instinct. It might show up different than you imagine it will. And so that's, I kind of want to add that in there.
Oh, I'm so glad you did. Beatrice, I love how you explain this system. I mean, like, as a total typology nerd, it makes me super horny. So anytime you want to like jump in and make a clarification like that, please do.
Okay. Great. So going back to your first question. So would you like me to just describe the three different sixes? Would that be a good way to do
sure.
this?
Sure. And you also might want to, with your two as well, you could talk about how maybe you would have showed up differently with the different subtypes. I don't know if we have enough time for all that. Well, let's just start with 6. Let's do that. And we can route back to you if we've got time. I don't know.
And one of the reasons why I'm thinking about doing that is because, I mean, we've self-diagnosed as these subtypes. And it's based on, you know, reading your book and finding some descriptors that are, you know, for me, the three one-to-one or sexual subtype seem to hit me pretty dead on. But at the same time, we're not experts in the Enneagram like we are in Myers-Briggs. So we might have an interesting piece of information surface as you talk about it that has us like maybe getting more calibrated to a different type. So that's one of the reasons why I think it would be interesting to talk about.
Agreed.
Yeah. If you'd be willing.
Yeah. Sure. Okay, so talking about type 6. Now, type 6 is a particularly interesting set of three subtypes because they're so different from one another. And this also occurs in type 4, where they look different. They're really different. And to the point where Claudio Naranjo, you know, the source of this version of the subtypes, he says you almost can't even talk about 1-6. So I've noticed when I'm doing like basic introductions to the Enneagram and you just want to talk about the 9 types because you don't want to overwhelm people and talk about 27 types right off the bat, I notice when I get to 6, it's really hard because there's not very many things I can say that all 6s do.
And is this why 6s are always described as having sort of like Janus-like quality? Not because 6s themselves are necessarily as contradictory within themselves, but because the subtypes show up so different?
I think so. I think that's part of it. I also think it's related to the fact that, you know, fear is kind of a core characteristic, a core, like, structuring the personality of the 6. Mm-hmm. And we all know that fear can show up in different ways. You know, fear reactions, rather, can show up in different ways. For instance, everyone's familiar with the idea of fight or flight. right? And so there's one kind of six that engages more in flight and one that engages more in fight.
Mm.
And then there's a third kind that engages more in sort of finding a protective authority so they can feel safe. So there are these three kinds of sixes are based in a certain way on three very different ways of trying to manage fear and anxiety.
That makes sense. So how do they show up, each of these types?
Okay, so the self-preservation six shows up as a very warm, friendly person. So this is someone who is more actively aware of their fear. Some sixes, as you might know, aren't really aware that they're driven by fear. And some, I hear a lot of sixes say that they didn't even really know that they were fearful until they learned the Enneagram. And it kind of said fear is a big thing for you. And so, you know, as with a lot of these Enneagram qualities, a lot of it can operate outside of awareness until, and that's what the Enneagram is good at doing. But self-preservation six is someone who's actively fearful and who tends to solve, you know, automatically solve the problem of fear or insecurity by making alliances with other people, by gathering a friendly group of people around them, or finding protectors. So if you want to find a protector, if you want people to sort of bunch together with you in the face of the enemy, you're going to want to be a friendly person that's nice to be around and maybe not very aggressive. So the self-preservation six is a six that tends not to be very in touch with their aggression or doesn't react from aggression very often, but on the contrary is more friendly and warm. This is also the six that's the most ambiguous or the most has the hardest time with doubt and uncertainty. So like all sixes, they want certainty, but they almost never find it. So things seem, the world seems very gray to the self-preservation six, and you can hardly say anything is black or white. And there's a lot of questioning and there's a lot of doubt. It's one of these people who can doubt everything, and they're looking for, you know, what they can feel safe and trusting, but everything can be doubted and questioned. They can even doubt their doubt. So it's a person who is actively fearful, wanting to be protected by others. Fear manifests as a kind of separation anxiety, and so they can want to be with close others as a way of feeling safe. The social six is a more intellectual six. So if the, I like to say the self-preservation six is kind of a two-ish six, so it's sort of a friendly person who wants to make connections with people. The social six is more of an intellectual person, more of a cool character. And this is someone who solves the problem or attempts to solve the problem of fear with finding a good authority and then placing, like looking to that authority and rules and guidelines associated with that authority to follow in order to find safety. And this, when I talk about authority, this doesn't necessarily mean a person. It can be an ideology or a way of thinking or something like science. They tend to be very rational thinkers. And so these are people who kind of want to find an authority and then know the rules and reference points of that authority. And then they can sort of relax because they know what to do under certain circumstances. And so the fearfulness comes more from ambiguity or uncertainty. So very different than the self-preservation six, who sort of lives in a lot of ambiguity and uncertainty. The ambiguity makes the social six feel anxious. And so they find a way to not be ambiguous. And so they see the world more in terms of black and white. And they tend to like a system of rules. Recently, I was doing a panel of sixes. And one guy said, you know, one of the things that makes me really anxious is when someone changes the rules on me. But at the same time, there are sixes. And so at times they can also rebel against the rules. But most of all, they're looking for a protective authority. And then the one-to-one six is different again. They deal with their fear through more taking it on, head on. So this is a six that has the idea that the best defense is a good offense. So this is the fight six. This is a more aggressive person. This is someone who can relate to their, sort of react to fear, not by, they usually, one-to-one sixes are what we call the most counterphobic six. This is a six that goes against their fear from a position of strength. So in order to ward off fear, usually sometimes they don't even register the fear, again, because that would make them less able to kind of move forward in a assertive way to meet their fear. They kind of try to be scary themselves. And so they and again, this can be everything from the way they dress to making themselves strong physically. And they kind of move in the world in a way that is threatening to others, intimidating. And again, oftentimes they're not really thinking about this or trying to be intimidating. It's just sort of the way they hold themselves. And they tend not to trust very many people. They mainly trust themselves. This is the more risk taker type, the person who's, you know, rock climbing or jumping out of planes, because they feel most safe when they're going to meet their anxiety, when they're sort of dancing with danger and showing their strength and resilience by being able to meet different dangers head on.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I think your self-diagnosis, Joel, of the 1-to-1-6 still sounds pretty spot on.
as you're talking about that, you know, just indulge me for a moment here. I do want to be physically strong. Like, in fact, that's one of my projects for the next year, is to try to work on my physical health and strength. But I think, like, as you're talking, can it manifest through wanting to control lots of resource and direction of, like, for example, Personality Hacker is a company or business in the business world? I'm guessing it can manifest itself through strength in, like, resource and business acumen and the ability to make things happen in that world too. I'm guessing that could translate, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I find that a lot of 1-to-1-6s often relate to 3 a lot, because they can be doers who kind of are you know, wanting to be powerful in the world as a way of exhibiting strength.
Yeah, we've talked about that actually, Joel, like your desire to be dominant in all situations. Like, it's just this.
Yeah, but friendly. I mean, I don't want to be a jerk about it, but I do want to be in charge a lot. Like, I have a better experience when I'm the one controlling the frame. For some reason, that's how I like to show up in that way. So I don't know. I'm guessing. So this all seems about right for the self-diagnosis so far.
Yeah. Well, and I guess the question I would have is what advice would you give to somebody of that subtype? You know, since we're talking about Joel, that, you know, for personal development projects, for becoming the best version of this particular subtype of the 1-to-1-6, what would be the best advice?
Right. Well, I mean, what you can probably already hear, one thing to point out right away is that there'll be different advice for each of these 3 types of sixes. So one of the things it highlights is, if you're a coach or you're someone that works with people using the Enneagram, one size does not fit all, even among the 3 sixes or any of the other subtypes. So for the 1-to-1-6, it's a lot about getting in touch with vulnerability and fear, first of all. Because oftentimes 1-to-1-6 will act from fear, but without any consciousness of the fear that's motivating what they're doing. So they may act in a powerful way or to take control. But because the sort of root motive of that isn't always clear to that person, they can get in trouble. You know, so someone can be acting aggressively and not realize that they're acting aggressively to the degree to which they feel vulnerable and unsafe. And so in order to moderate the aggression, you know, because it's a lot about doing things consciously and moderating tendencies that can get out of hand, you're going to want to understand where it's coming from and what the real root of it is, so that you're not just acting out in ways that you don't understand yourself. And the more you understand that what your vulnerability feels like and how it motivates you and what you do in response, the more you'll be able to, you know, be more choiceful and conscious about the things that you're doing. And so for the 1-to-1, it's like recognizing the vulnerability and the fear that often they just kind of skip over, and knowing that's underneath there, and having a lot of compassion for yourself around any fear or vulnerability, and learning to be more comfortable with it, learning to communicate about it with others, learning to get really aware of what triggers it, and then what you do in response, and slow that whole thing down so that you can be more aware of, okay, maybe I don't want to need to be in control in this situation. Or maybe it's good not to have aggressive response here as opposed to having it be more of a knee-jerk thing.
Yeah, yeah. And I can also see emerging from this, at least from my experience, and I'm guessing other sixes in the same vein have a challenge where in order to recognize that fear in ourselves, we feel silly or we're taking an ego hit to do so. And so it's almost like, if I recognize that, now I got to deal with this whole like, oh, I feel silly or stupid, or and that aggression I can see covering over having to be vulnerable or having to like showcase how I might feel, you know, feel like I'm letting something show, the fear show to other people that maybe I'm in a leadership position over or with. And that's like, oh, will that undermine my leadership? Will that undermine my ability to get things done? So this like play with that and being able to be vulnerable in the midst of showing up and wanting to still be in that leadership role or something like that. I'm spitballing, but I can already see how useful it is to start seeing things in those terms. So it resonates
exactly.
A lot.
Right, right. And one of the things, you know, when you study leadership, one of the things you find is that the most effective leaders are people who are able to self-disclose in a mindful, selective way, vulnerability with the people they're leading, because it makes them more trustworthy and more approachable.
Yeah. Yeah. This is good stuff. Cool.
Yeah.
Thank you. Do you want to move on to Antonia? Because I know we want to keep going at a good clip, I guess.
Yeah. Let's talk about threes a little bit,
okay.
If you wouldn't mind.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. This was learning about these three threes was huge for me. Because this is a good example of, so before I learned this approach to the subtypes, they only really talked about one kind of three, which is the social three. The self-preservation three and the one-to-one three, I had never heard these types described before. So one of the really important reasons that it's important to know the subtypes connected to the Enneagram, if you're going to use the system, is there are types that the 27 describe that are not included, that just don't get mentioned when you hear about the nine types alone. And so in the three, the self-preservation three is a three I had never heard of at all. And the self-preservation three is, so threes generally are people who want others to see them in a positive light. They sort of live for, and they're very good at being people who can kind of match up with or become the image of whatever the people around them view as successful and competent. So especially in terms of success and competence and productivity and getting things done and getting results, threes want people to see them in a very positive light. So self-preservation threes are threes who are very hard workers. And while they're also people who want to be seen by others in a positive light, they're very sensitive about being seen to brag or boast or show off, because self-preservation threes don't just want to get things done and have a good image like most threes do, but they also want to be good. Because again, if your security is tied to what you do in a deeper way, as they are with self-preservation subtypes, then it becomes even more important that what you do not only looks good, but that actually is good, that there's actually a quality element to it, because again, your security is riding on it. And so there's a way that these are people who want to be the best or a good model of whatever it is they are, whether it's the good parent or a good worker or a good partner. They want to be seen as a good model of that as determined by social consensus. And so they want to be virtuous, self-preservation threes. And if you're going to be virtuous, it means not being vain or not being someone who in an obvious way wants other people to see them in a positive light, right? So these are people who, when Naranjo says, have vanity for having no vanity. So vanity is a core issue for threes. Again, it's that wanting to be seen positively in the eyes of others. And so the self-preservation three wants to be seen in a positive light, but doesn't want to admit it or feels awkward and embarrassed about that. And so I can't tell you how many self-preservation threes have told me that they, because, you know, a lot of threes are often are very successful because they work really hard and are very achievement oriented. And I often hear self-preservation threes say something along the lines of, I used to have a Mercedes, but I was embarrassed to drive it because I was embarrassed to be seen in it because it's this icon of success, but I'm sensitive to being too ostentatious or obvious about my success. And so I traded it in for a Prius. So there's a way that they're they're uncomfortable wearing names, you know, designer names on their, you know, because again, it's this sensitivity, wanting to be seen as virtuous and good, which means not being seen as too vain. And it also, there are also people who probably are the biggest workaholics on the Enneagram, because again, not only are they competent doers like most threes are, but they have this added element of a kind of fear, anxiety about material security. And often these are people who learn to be doers early on in life. So sometimes the sort of the archetypal protector or provider, like which is the father, wasn't there in some way or was ineffectual. And so learn that they kind of have to make it happen themselves. And so these tend to be people who get a lot done, who are very successful, who work really, really, really hard, very autonomous, self-sufficient people, but also people who have the hardest time slowing down and making time for themselves and making time for self-care. And so you can already hear where the developmental path is going to focus for that three. So then the social three is not as concerned as they're not embarrassed about wanting to look good. This is the three that most of us have heard about that likes recognition, that likes to be on stage. And, you know, the social three likes it, that the self-preservation three likes that too, but doesn't want to be obvious about it. But the social three is more out there and really good at looking good. Sometimes you can't, you know, they have a kind of a flawless appearance. More of a corporate mentality, more wanting to look good, and it doesn't necessarily have to be perfect, but it, as long as it looks good. Someone who's a more competitive person. People sometimes think all threes are competitive, but it's really the social three that's most competitive. Self-preservation threes say they compete against their own past record. And one-to-one threes, as we'll see, are more relationship-oriented. And so sometimes it doesn't really make sense to them to be super competitive, because even though they are to an extent, because they're very supportive of others. And so they don't want to be competing against everyone else, because they tend to be, you know, sort of rooting for, cheering on the people that surround them as well. But for the social three, it's a lot about being on stage, on doing what's good for the group or the company. And they tend to be a more aggressive, more competitive three, more out there, sort of bigger, larger than life, looks a little bit more. So if the self-preservation three can look a little one-ish because they want to look good, a little bit like a type one, the social three can especially in men, can sometimes be confused with a type eight, because it's a leader type. It's someone who wants to be in charge. It's someone who is more out there competing on stage and really relishing the experience of getting everyone's applause.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a hard time Well, I was just going to mention that it took me a while to self-diagnose as a three, because that was the three description I read a lot, and I didn't identify with that one.
Yeah. And I find that's really true. And when I'm bringing the Enneagram into a business setting and I'm helping people find their type in the beginning, some of the type descriptions about three are written in terms of the social three. And so the people will say, well, I don't relate to that. And so often I have to describe the three subtypes at the beginning of the three, just to let someone know, well, you can be a three and not be super competitive or super out there, partly because there are these two different versions that are a bit different. And this, and the one-to-one is different again, in that this is a person who is very focused on presenting an attractive image and on relationships, and especially on supporting others. And so in many ways, one-to-one threes, even though they're very hardworking and in the same way that the other threes are, they often feel like their success is tied more to other people's success. So they feel like they've had a big win if, like, someone they're supporting has a big win. And they often get into roles where they're in, you know, supporting other people and working very hard on the behalf of other people. So a lot about being attractive and attracting partners and positive relationships, but then working really hard, you know, so that others succeed and not just themselves.
Can that also show up as in the one-to-one subtype, or I'm getting that terminology correct, right? Yes. Can it also show up as them seeing the potential in somebody else that that other person can't even see, and then getting into a relationship with them based on the potential of that other person rather than the actuality of that other person?
Yes, I think I think one-to-one threes are really good at seeing other people's potential and the path to getting there, right? So threes are really good at making things happen. And so yes. And so I would say, it's more of a two-ish three. And that's something also twos can do, is kind of fall in love with someone's potential as opposed to where they really are. But threes are really, one-to-one threes are very good cheerleaders and supporters. And so they can often do a lot of the work to help you manifest your potential, and help you see the steps you need to take and the path that you need to go to get there.
So I massively identify with that. I think that's one of the reasons why I started to become a life coach, was because I enjoyed cheerleading so much and watching people, you know, supporting their journey of flourishing. But what's one of the major blind spots of people of this subtype? Like, if I wanted to really leverage an understanding of my subtype in order to become the best version of it, what do you think your best advice would be?
Well, it's interesting. The one-to-one three is the most emotional of the three threes. And there can sometimes be a bit of a sadness underneath because their focus is so much on others and sometimes not on connecting with themselves as much. So the blind spot for one-to-one threes can be not putting so much of your energy into helping others or supporting others, but also putting equal amount of energy into knowing yourself, connecting with your feelings, and kind of nourishing yourself in the same way that you support other people.
Yeah, I can definitely resonate with that. And not even like, because that, you know, when we talk about things like that, you know, you make sure that you're also putting on your own oxygen mask. And I think there's this sort of sense of like, that's very noble. Like we've turned it into a virtue to deny the self and worry about other people. So it can almost sound really, really good. But for me personally, and just in the spirit of transparency, that usually means that I've been ignoring myself to a point where that now I'm like incapable of being even close to my best self. Like I'll go into like, you know, I'll emotionally explode, or I'll build these narratives and stories about how people are against me, or I'll just feel like a general sense of, like you said, sadness, like this undercurrent of sadness that it's very difficult to remove myself from. So I've started to see all of that as very much a vice of mine, not a virtue at all. And that it's, you know, I can really tell how the narrative sounds good of like denying the self in behalf of others, but it actually ends up being like very much a crutch. And that is, you know, understanding what my emotional experience is, just being in touch with what I'm feeling while I'm feeling it, which is a massive blind spot for me. That's one of the reasons why I was super attracted to Joel, is Joel's very good at that. He's very good at identifying emotions. He'll know I'm feeling something before I'm feeling it. He'll be like, "You okay?" And I'm like, "I'm fine." And he's like, "Nah, I don't think you're fine." So that is very much, I know, an area of my blind spot for me. And so it's good to know that direction, heading into the direction of getting more in touch with that place, is the growth path for people of my subtype.
Absolutely, yeah. And one-to-one threes can be quite disconnected from themselves, even while they can be connected to other people. And so, and also, I think, like you're saying, threes often get rewarded for what their personality style sort of motivates them to do in the world, but too much of a good thing in the Enneagram becomes a bad thing, right? So too much caretaking of others, too much supporting others, especially to the neglect of yourself, becomes a not very good thing. And so absolutely, for someone like you, it's going to be really, really important for you to make sure and leave time and space for you to connect more with yourself in whatever ways you might need to.
So I know that we're going to have to wrap this up. I mean, I personally would go through all 27 subtypes if we had the time and the space for it, because I find this infinitely interesting.
Maybe someday.
But I don't think we're going to be able to do that now. So can you, just to kind of, you know, head towards landing the plane and wrapping it up, can you, for our audience member who maybe is still trying to figure out what their subtype is and the best information, Can you give like a general piece of advice for people who want to go down this road? And then let our audience know, like the person who's listening, how can they find you? How can they find more information about their subtype or helping them diagnose it and go further down this rabbit hole?
Yeah, basically, I think what Antonio's asking you for, I think we would recommend people go get your book. I think that's a good starting point. And then once they get your book, I'm brand new, I'm listening right now to the three of us talk. I want to go get your book, and then how do I best use that? Do I just read it, or is there a way that I can apply it to my life the best way possible?
So the first book, The Complete Enneagram, I mean, I really designed it, you know, hopefully to be kind of a step-by-step guide about what is the Enneagram, how do you use it, how do you get into it? But at the same time, I don't think people necessarily read it cover to cover. You know, the first three chapters are very introductory, trying to bring people in step by step into what this is. But each of the chapters about the types are divided into three sections. One is the first, just what is this type like in terms of its focus of attention and its defense mechanisms and its view of the world and its basic characteristics. And then the second piece of each type chapter is about the three subtypes. So there's a couple pages of description and also something written by a person of that subtype describing their own experience. So it's not just me telling you what someone's type and subtype, telling you about a subtype that I can't know from the inside because that's not mine, but someone who is that type. And then the third section of each type chapter is about, okay, now that you know a little bit about your type and subtype, how do you make that work for you? What's some of the work that you can do? What might you focus on in terms of self-observation, which is the first step for using the Enneagram, is starting to see, okay, how do I see these patterns showing up in my life? And, you know, a lot of people, when they learn the Enneagram, they want to take a test, like most of us would, and sort of find out what their type is that way. But with the Enneagram, it's a bit tricky because a lot of the tests that are available online and things are not very accurate. So if you do take a test, I would just say really hold the results lightly. Use it as one data point as opposed to the final answer. And then really look at, read the book and see how does this relate to me? And maybe ask people who know you really well, because part of the tricky part about finding your type is that we all have blind spots. And the Enneagram shows you those blind spots, sometimes, as you were saying, Joel, in a kind of an uncomfortable way. Once you find your, being honest with yourself about which of these descriptions do I relate to the most. And you will relate to more than one type usually, because the Enneagram maps the complexity of the human personality quite well, and we're complex. And you usually will relate to more than one type because your type has access to both the wing points, which are the types right next to you, and other types that you're connected to in the diagram. But I think the best, there's no better way to really find yourself other than just really doing some reading and some reflecting and taking the time to kind of really use it as a jumping off point for a deeper self-exploration.
Yeah. Well, and I think that our audience that is into typology is savvy enough to know that taking an online test is a starting point, not the destination, because the same phenomenon occurs in the Myers-Briggs system as well. So I think that's a good reminder.
Where can people find more about you? I'm guessing they could find your books, both your books. And what's the title of the second book again, the newest book you just released?
Is called The 9 Types of Leadership, Mastering the Art of People in the 21st Century Workplace.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure you got that in there because I knew the subtitle was long. I wanted to make sure it was accurate. Both can be found on major booksellers, online and Amazon, I'm guessing, all of those normal locations you'd find a book. Where can people find, you have a website, right? Could you give us your website where people can start their journey in finding more about you, your practice, your books, all the things that you do, Beatrice?
Sure. My website is beatricechestnut.com. And you can find some Enneagram resources there, descriptions of the types, the list of workshops that I do all over. And I'll be posting more and more blogs and adding more information there all the time.
Okay, great.
And we'll have a link in the show notes too.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll have a link to all of this.
Yeah, in the podcast notes. I just really want to thank you so much for taking your time to be on our podcast today and sharing your 27 years of research and all of the ahas that you've gotten on this wonderful subject, complex but very accessible the way that you teach it on the Enneagram.
Thank you so much. It's been really great talking to you both about this.
Yeah, I have to say, you sound so professional. I've heard you on other interviewed shows. And when I hear somebody that sounds so professional, so articulate, so put together, I always have to talk to them in real person to know that if that's a construction and they're actually not a good person and they're just like constructing all this, or if they're like, or if it's coming from like a place of legitimate, like embodied goodness and authenticity and realness. And I can say, just talking to you beforehand, before we started recording, your laughter, the way you show up and just you own yourself, command of the material, everything about you oozes authenticity. Somebody that I feel instantly I can trust around this.
Yeah.
Like your knowledge, you're not shying it on. If you didn't know something, you'd say it.
Yeah.
And I just really appreciate that about you. Yeah. I wish more people showed up the way you're showing up, because I think it's amazing how you're showing up to the world presenting this information. I just want to make a comment about that I really like your energy too, not just what you're saying, but who you are. So thank you.
Wow, thank you. That's a huge, huge compliment. I really believe you need to walk the talk if you're doing this stuff. And so I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, you're the real deal for sure.
So what do you think? You've been listening to Antonia, myself, and Beatrice talk about the Enneagram. Maybe you've got some experience in the Enneagram. Maybe you've read some books. You've been around the world. Maybe you've gone really deep into the Enneagram and you've got some thoughts or questions, some nuances. Things you heard today, you're like, well, I've never heard it presented that way before. I've got tons of questions now. Come over to personalityhacker.com, ask a question or leave a comment directly below this show. Let's get a discussion started. You don't have a microphone right now. Your microphone is coming over to the website, leaving a comment, asking a question, and being part of an emerging discussion. And in fact, if you want to join a community of like minds, we'd love to see you over at facebook.com/personalityhacker. Or twitter.com/personalityhack, H-A-C-K. They wouldn't let us put the whole hacker in there. Join the community of people that want to talk about this stuff with us. Join in and be a part of the community this week around the Enneagram.
Yeah. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you can subscribe to us on iTunes and various Android platforms. And if you would be willing to leave us a rating and review on iTunes, that would help us out a lot.
My name is Joel Mark Witt.
And I'm Antonia Dodge.
Thanks to our guest, Beatrice Chestnut, for being on the show today. We'll talk with you on the next Personality Hacker podcast.